Patrick, missionary to Ireland. Now, as the Reformation Society may wonder, what are we doing looking at a Catholic saint? Well, he was by no means a Roman Catholic. He was an evangelical, Bible-believing, born-again evangelist, a missionary to Ireland, sinner, slave, and saint. We know him as Saint Patrick, but in his book, Confessions, he starts off Patrick, a sinner. So he never called himself a saint, but he was both a sinner and a slave, and by God's grace became a saint. Patrick was only 16 years old when he saw a fleet of 50 longboats heading for the shore. As the Roman legions had long since departed Britain, Patrick's home was vulnerable to attack. And today the Irish complain about the English invading them, but they forget about when the Irish invaded England. And the Irish used to raid England for slaves. And you can see Patrick came from probably Wales, possibly England, but that's the first surprise about Patrick. He wasn't born in Ireland. As the Irish raiders leapt from their boats onto the pebbled beach, sounding the war horns, the population fled in terror. I mean, imagine 16 years old, war suddenly comes to your town. And the attackers looted and they burned the village. They carried away captives, including young Patrick. Now, the year was 405 AD. Patrick's name in Latin was Patricius, meaning noble. You know, the patricians, the plebeians, well, he was from a noble family, Roman, English, home. His father was a magistrate. His grandfather was a deacon in the church. His mother was a dedicated believer. He came from a very prestigious family. He had had a privileged childhood. He had been raised with all the comforts, but now he became a slave in Ireland. And Patrick was sold to a cruel warrior chief. His stockade in Northern Ireland was surrounded by sharp poles with the heads of opponents impaled on him. So it gives you an idea of the kind of person there was there. Patrick was put to work as a shepherd to care for his master's pigs and sheep. He lived a lonely existence in the nearby hills, this mountain they called the Slemish Mountains, enduring long bouts of hunger and thirst, isolated from human company for months at a time. He wouldn't see another person. Patrick witnessed the superstitions of the Druids and the priests who sacrificed prisoners of war to the war gods and newborns to the harvest gods. So human sacrifice was normal. This is a very debased culture. Skulls were used as drinking bowls. Heads of decapitated enemies were used as footballs. In this strange land at the ends of the earth, amongst these fierce people, Patrick remembered the faith of his father and of his grandfather and the prayers of his mother, and he turned to Christ. He looked at his capture at age 16 and enslavement as God's judgment upon him for wasting his youth, for not taking seriously the privilege he had, for not being serious about God, and he had wasted opportunities. He had been given it all, and he had never had a personal relationship with the Lord, even though he was brought up in a believing home that loved the Lord, that feared the Lord. He was taught the faith, and yet here he was as a slave in a foreign land, probably would never see his family again, and he turned to the God of his father and mother and grandfather. Kneeling on the slopes of the Slemish Mountain, near what is today the town of Ballymena, Patrick prayed, and he said sometimes he prayed 100 times a day. After 6 years of slavery, Patrick was led by the Lord to escape and ran nearly 200 miles. He had a vision, and he followed this vision that there's a boat waiting for him to take him back to his homeland if he would go in this way, and he is led by the Lord to a coastal port where he's able to persuade a captain to take him along with a shipment of Irish wolfhounds. And off he was on this boat, and a storm blew them off course, and they landed on the coast of Gaul, what today is France. Attacks by Vandals devastated the area. There was no food to be had in this once fertile area. Here, Patrick was able to repay the kindness of the ship captain by praying for the Lord's provision and seeing a herd of pigs appear. Now, at that time, the map of Europe did not look like it looks right now. And you will recall the Western Roman Empire collapsed. The Eastern Roman Empire, the Byzantine Empire, was still on the go. At this stage, you didn't have what was called England. The Angles hadn't yet landed to take over Britain and call it Angleland. So he was brought up in Britain, named after Brutus. Brutus was one of the survivors from Troy. And so Britain, or the land of Brutus, Britain, is named after one of the survivors of the battles of Troy. And so the Britons, the Celtic people who claim lineage back to Troy. The Angles invaded and turned it into Angleland or England. And the Saxons added as well, and the Jutes from Jutland, and they formed what today would be understood to be England. And so you started to have, by the 6th century, the Angli and the Saxons coming over. And at this stage, you've got nothing resembling France or Germany. You've just got these different tribes running amok in different parts of Europe. Patrick now received a Macedonian call. He was safe, he was free, he's back in Bruton, Britain. And in this vision, an Irishman called Victoricus presented him with letters entitled The Voice of the Irish. We appeal to you, holy servant boy, to come and walk among us again. Now, you would think, having been kidnapped, enslaved, he would never want to see Ireland again. But Patrick says he was pierced to his heart and he returned to land where he had suffered as a slave many years before. Very brave thing to do, because what's the chances that the person he fled from wanted to have him tortured, put to death, whatever, in order to be an example. Very courageous to go back to Ireland. Patrick was over 40 years old when he arrived in 432 as a missionary to Ireland. Now, today, Patrick is depicted in mitred archbishop's outfit with all his medieval Catholic garb right down to the crook stick, which is very anachronistic. You know, it would be like depicting him driving a Ferrari and wearing a watch. It didn't exist in those days. Patrick was an evangelist. He was a Bible-believing man. He never went to Rome. He wasn't ordained as a Catholic priest. He wasn't a bishop. He was nothing to the Catholic Church. And there was no Roman Catholic influence on his life, nor in Ireland at that time. So the fact that the Catholics have hijacked Patrick to the point that the average Protestant thinks, I don't want anything to do with Patrick. It just shows how well the propaganda's gone, the myth-making. But when you read Patrick's confessions, well, there's two books we've got of his. Confessions is one. And don't confuse that with the Confessions written by St. Augustine. That's another Confessions book. And by the way, Confessions doesn't mean, as we may think today, Confessions meaning like confessing your sins to a priest. It's just another word for declaration. It's or testimony. So Confessions would have been, in our terms, we would have probably used the word testimony. So Patrick's Confessions, it's his testimony in a real sense. And when you read this, you see nothing of Rome, nothing of the Pope, nothing of Catholicism. What you see, there's a Bible-believing man who believed in the Trinity, who feared God, who loved God, who wanted to win people to Christ, who's inspired by the Great Commission. So Protestants should not be afraid of these heroes of the faith just because they've been turned to Roman Catholic priests in stained glass windows and all the rest. Well, these are some of the places which Patrick ministered in, like Armagh and Downpatrick and Slane and Schlemish and Ardar and Lothering and Croagh Patrick and Saul. You'll notice most of Patrick's ministry is up in what today would be called Northern Ireland, Protestant Ireland. This is a great frustration to Catholics that their patron saint, the epitome of all that's Catholic, is in Protestant hands. Even his grave is in the graveyard of a Protestant church. So they really want Ulster. They want to get back that area, which, because Catholics, when they want to make pilgrimages to his graves, they've got to go to Protestant areas and even to a Protestant church to do so. Well, Patrick faced fierce opposition from the Druids. These are like the witch doctors of Europe at that time. Patrick survived numerous attempts in his life, and he confronted idolatry, immorality, slavery, human sacrifices. These were very savage tribes. I mean, this is just like what would have been experienced by Henry Morton Stanley going at the heart of darkness down the Congo River in the 1800s. I mean, these people were savage. They would take your head off and stick it on a pike and use it for decorations, drink blood out of the skull. I mean, they were as savage as could be, and You know, you look at Ireland today and you think, well, something must have changed. And well, that something was Patrick and the gospel of Christ. Daily I expect murder, fraud, or captivity, but I fear none of these things. Because of the promises of heaven, I have cast myself in the hands of God Almighty, who rules everything, everywhere. Patrick delighted in taking risks for the gospel. I must take this decision, disregarding risks involved. I must make known the gifts of God and his everlasting consolation. And as you travel around Ireland, you see signs like this. Near here is the reputed site of the well where St. Patrick baptized many of the local inhabitants in the 5th century AD. And these are just reminders, different places, the impact he had that can never be forgotten. This is Patrick's gravestone. Very simple. Just the word Patrick etched onto it, chiseled into it. Neither must I fear any such risk in faithfully preaching his God's name boldly in every place, so that even after my death, a spiritual legacy may be left for my brethren and my children. At Tara, Patrick challenged the Druids to a contest, and the Druids invoked demons and brought a dark fog over the land. And Patrick prayed, and suddenly the fog cleared, and the sun shone brightly, and the king ordered 27 chariots to go and seize Patrick. Patrick prayed aloud, "May God come up to scatter his enemies, and may those who hate him flee from his face," and the charioteers fell dead. And Patrick rebuked the king and said, "If you do not believe now, you will die on the spot, for the wrath of God descends on your head." And the king fell on his knees before the missionary and pledged his realm to Christ, and many turned to Christ that day. This is like a Elijah on the Mount Carmel challenging the prophets of Baal type of experience. And I don't know how many of you recall the name Tara. Where have you heard the name Tara before? Gone with the Wind, the name of the farm. Tara, because those were Irishmen in Georgia, in America. Tara is a famous place from Ireland. Well, one of Patrick's letters was a letter writing, communicating to the tyrant Caritacus, who's one of the tribal kings, who had carried off some of Patrick's converts into slavery. And so he formally excommunicated them for engaging in slavery and so on. Well, within his lifetime, Patrick ended the slave trade in Ireland. The legend that Patrick drove all the snakes out of Ireland has more to do with the spiritual warfare in driving out the demons from the land than any snakes. There probably weren't snakes in Ireland to start with, so driving the snakes out of Ireland is probably more symbolic of driving the demons out. The famous Larica, Patrick's breastplate, prayer of protection, expresses Patrick's confidence in God to protect him from every famine, from every fierce, merciless force that may come upon body and soul, incantations of false prophets, black laws of paganism, deceit of idolatry, and spells of druids. Christ be with me, Christ within me, Christ behind me, Christ before me, Christ beside me, Christ to win me, Christ to comfort and restore me, Christ beneath me, Christ above me, Christ in quiet, Christ in danger, Christ in hearts of all that love me, Christ in mouth of friend and stranger. That's part of the breastplate of St. Patrick, said to be his daily prayer before going out to wage war against the Druids. Patrick was one of the first great missionaries that brought the gospel beyond the boundaries of the old Roman civilization. In fact, in his book, he assumes that he is at the uttermost ends of the earth and the Irish are the last people in the world to hear the gospel. They didn't know that there was Iceland, Greenland, Canada, the Americas beyond. Ireland was the ends of the earth from the perspective of people in Europe. And so he regularly is thinking that he's now winning the last tribes at the ends of the earth, which from their perspective and their time and place makes sense. Patrick's missionary strategy was to concentrate on converting the tribal kings. And this actually is the history of Europe for especially the first 1,000 years. Missionaries tended to concentrate on winning the kings, the chiefs, the family heads, the tribal leaders, because once you convert the head, the rest will follow. And that's proven to be a whole lot more effective. So just take, for example, in history, when Prince Vladimir in 988 AD of the Russians in Kiev was converted and baptized, he then ordered all the Russians to be converted. And to this day, they look back at this as the beginning of the conversion of the Russian people and the Ukrainian people. They look at the same date, 988, and Prince Vladimir the Great, or Saint Vladimir. And this was, the Bulgarians were converted this way. the Vikings would convert this way. As the Vikings were converted, they would give the order to all the men, baptism or battle. Be converted or die. And this was kind of normal. Now, being forced to be converted doesn't save anyone. It's not regeneration. But it does put them in the way of evangelism and discipleship and the hearing of the gospel, in which real evangelism takes place. But through the history of Europe, most peoples, the Saxons, the Franks, the Vikings, they were all converted by the top down. The king was converted, like King Clovis of the Franks ordered all the Franks to get converted and so on. Sadly, in the 20th century, an individualism took over that's gone off the rails. So, for example, in 1945, after the atom bombs were dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and Japan surrendered, and the American governor, for want of a better word, was sent to rule Japan, General MacArthur, he received the emperor of the Japanese, Emperor Hiroshi, came to him and said, I suppose I must be baptized and become a Christian, which makes sense. He was a god. Shintoism worships the emperor. Half of the people of Japan were Shintos and the other half were Buddhist. And here he had been defeated, and so he assumed he must now take on the religion of those who had conquered him. And sadly, so much had radical individualism taken over America that General MacArthur is normally a good man, and I don't want to sound like I'm criticizing him, but unfortunately he gave the answer of, no, that's a personal decision. I think that's such a missed opportunity. Imagine if in 1945 the Emperor of Japan had converted to Christianity, we'd have a better situation than we have now, where only 3% of the total population of Japan are Christians in name only. I'm not even talking about real Christians now, just nominally. And how tragic. Now, General MacArthur did do something very positive. He called for churches in America to send missionaries to Japan. He said, we need at least 10,000 missionaries. Japan is wide open to the gospel in this time of defeat. But unfortunately, very few answered, and it was just a couple of dozen came instead of 10,000 he asked for. They could mobilize millions of soldiers, but they couldn't mobilize that many missionaries to Japan. And what a missed opportunity if in this day and age, imagine 1945, something good could have come out of that horrible war if Japan had been converted. Just imagine. But Patrick Strachey, as of many other missionaries at that time, was concentrate in converting the tribal kings. And as the kings were converted, and as they were baptized and they took their occult instruments and had them burned in the fire, they entrusted their sons, the princes, to Patrick to be trained as missionaries. And they were trained in many of these monasteries, many of which the kings provided to be built up and supplied for the very purpose of training their sons and others to be missionaries of the gospel. So from kingdom to kingdom, Patrick converted pagans. He built churches. He trained disciples. He ordained deacons and ministers, and he built mission stations. And Patrick provided pastors with written doctrinal standards with which to teach their people. For 30 years, from age 40 to 70, Patrick evangelized Ireland. He converted many chiefs and kings. He established over 300 congregations. That's just staggering. You know, that would be an achievement today with our modern forms of transportation and printing press and so on. But imagine doing that while you've got to walk everywhere and over a place that doesn't really have that much infrastructure. He is said to have baptized 120,000 people. That's staggering, especially when you bear in mind, unlike Rishi in China, he believed in first catechizing them and discipling them before baptizing them. This wasn't just taking them through the waters as Spanish conquistadors want to do this. This was a real discipleship process. So he really evangelized and discipled Ireland. Patrick became an inspiring example for Celtic Christians. By the way, can I just point out to you, it's Celtic, not Celtic. First time I went to Ireland, my host endured it for a few moments and said, I'm sorry, but I must stop you. That's not Celtic, it's Celtic. And how could I forget that? Sorry for mispronouncing it for many years, but it's Celtic Christians. His life of continuous prayer, his love for the scriptures, his love of God's creation, his missionary vision inspired many hundreds of Celts to take the gospel to Scotland and England and throughout the continent of Europe. And here you can see some of the monasteries that were established by Patrick and his disciples, not just all over Ireland, from Armagh and down Patrick, all over to Iona. Now, there's a famous mission station. And from Iona went Columba, one of the great missionaries who once got into Christ, who is a fruit of Patrick's work. And Lindisfarne, which is one of the great missionary sending posts of history, which is where the Vikings began their raids, 793 AD. Whitby, Glastonbury, Malmesbury. How many people knew there's a Malmesbury in England as well, which our Malmesbury is named after? So these mission stations, these are famous. You know, you could think of mission stations today like Kwasi Sabantu Mission and Korma Mission Station. Well, you might think of Carnarvon. Well, these were the names of those times. And Lindisfarne and Iona were particularly famous. The great prayer of St. Patrick has inspired many people. And here is one of his prayers. I rise today through a mighty strength, the invocation of the Trinity, through belief in the threeness, through confession of the oneness, towards the Creator, Christ for my guardianship today. Against poison, against burning, against drowning, against wounding, that there may come to me a multitude of rewards. I rise today through God's strength to pilot me, God's might to uphold me, God's wisdom to guide me, God's eye to look before me, God's eye to hear me, God's word to speak for me, God's hand to guard me, God's way to lie before me, God's shield to protect me, God's hosts to save me. I rise today through a mighty strength, the invocation of the Trinity. And so you can see a real emphasis on the Trinity in the teachings of Patrick. May the strength of God pilot us. May the wisdom of God instruct us. May the hand of God protect us. May the word of God direct us. And although Patrick is commonly called saint, he described himself as a sinner. In fact, Protestants try not to use the word Saint Patrick, although it's so much ingrained that we often do, because just Patrick or Patrick of Ireland or the missionary Patrick is better, because we slip into the Catholic term of saint. He was a saint in the sense that all those redeemed by the blood of Christ are by God's grace saints versus sinners, but where saint is only a sinner saved by grace. But of course, the Catholics have now got saint as a special class of Christian. Mother Teresa, that's the thing. Whereas what we would understand from the Protestant faith is there's no special class of Christians who are called saint. If you're a Christian at all, you're in the category of the saints. Not meaning that everything we do is good and holy, but we are set apart by the grace of God. Saints by the grace of God alone. So the Confession of St. Patrick's one of the books that one can have as a classic, and it was written in pretty poor Latin, very simple Latin, indicating, again, he never received formal training. There's no evidence that Patrick ever went to any theological school or the Catholic equivalent of that time. He was not well tutored. He was a fairly straightforward person. He had an excellent upbringing until age 16. But beyond that, there's no evidence he had the equivalent of university training, or there's no evidence he is ordained, and he certainly never went anywhere near Rome, and the Pope never gave him any authority. And by the way, I don't think he's ever been acknowledged to be a saint by the Roman Catholic Church. It's just as by popular claim within Ireland. Although Patrick is the acknowledged patron saint of the Irish, he was not actually born in Ireland, but in England, or in Wales. Not that we would have called it England, then it would have been Britain or Bruton. But back then, there's Britain, and there was Picts land, what today we call Scotland, there's Ireland. And it was later that the Angles turned into Angleland, and of course, things changed from there. It may also surprise people to know that Patrick is not canonized by the Roman Catholic Church. He has been considered the patron saint of Ireland as a result of popular devotion and long-standing tradition. And he never would have worn a hat like that or carried these sort of things, because those are like late Middle Ages. This is not the sort of outfit they would have had in the 4th and 5th century. On the last Sunday of every July, up to 30,000 pilgrims pass St. Patrick's statue and climb the top of Crow Patrick, commemorating Patrick's 40 days fast on a 2,710-foot summit, where, of course, there has to be a chapel. Well, that's newer these days. And so in Catholic Ireland, they tend to have statues of Patrick which anachronistically depict him looking like some Roman Catholic bishop. However, you see on the left the church that's built in memory of Patrick, and that dates back to probably his era, his century. And on the right is the Church of Ireland, which is a Protestant church, where his grave is today. This is a more Protestant depiction of Patrick in Northern Ireland. This depicts Patrick in the way that he would have been, more likely. Fairly short cropped hair, a simple staff, not this elegant bishop's crook. And the thing that's so amazing is that Patrick and his followers sent out missionaries to evangelize not only the rest of the British Isles, but much of the continent of Europe. There is a book out called How Ireland Saved Civilization, which was written by an Irishman, obviously, but it's not too much of an exaggeration, because after the ravages of the Vandals and the barbarians and chaos in Europe, the Irish later re-evangelized Europe to a large extent through people like Columba and Iona and Lindisfarne mission stations. Romans 15 verse 19 to 20 really describes the ministry of Patrick. In mighty signs and wonders, by the power of the Spirit of God, I fully preached the gospel of Christ, and so I've made it my aim to preach the gospel, not where Christ was named, lest I should build another man's foundation. And when you go to Patrick's monument and to his memorial in Ireland, it's actually run by the Protestants, and they've got the actual words of Patrick. It's so clear that he was not a Catholic. And despite these depictions of him, I mean, this is the way that Roman Catholic artists tended to depict him, but he never wore such fancy garb. And that is, it's nice mosaics, it's interesting art, and beautiful stained glass windows. But these do not depict how he would have dressed at that time, and there's no indication that he would have been dressing in that. He would have looked like somebody who came from time travel from outer space, because nobody had outfits like that in those days. But still, some beautiful stained glass windows, all the same. And it does depict something of the respect people in Ireland have for him. There's many churches named around the world after St. Patrick. You can get mountains of St. Patrick's churches and cathedrals in New York, and wherever you get Irish people, in Chicago and so on. So amazing that a humble missionary like Patrick could have so many impressive cathedrals named after him, and St. Patrick's Rock at Cashel, and the role of the Knights of the Most Illustrious Order of St. Patrick. And you've got more Catholic-looking things in Southern Ireland. I've seen this very place, and you look at this and think, Patrick wouldn't be very impressed with all these crucifixes and so on. Patrick was, in many ways, a pioneer missionary to Ireland, and the churches he left behind were evangelical. And this is the church grounds where Patrick is buried. And Lenore and I were invited to Ireland in 2009 by Dr. Ian Paisley to be part of the anniversary, the 150th anniversary of the Great Revival of 1859. And here's Patrick's simple grave. And it's a simple big rock which had carved into it his name and a cross. At this time, it was the Celts who were inhabiting England. But of course, later the Saxons, the Jutes, and the Angles came in and dominated and pushed the Celts into Wales and, of course, Ireland and Scotland. So the Celts of Wales, Ireland, and Scotland would be the original Britons or Brutons, and the Angles and Saxons and Jutes were more recent invaders from the 5th, 6th centuries on. And of course, the Normans came later. But Ireland, most of it's Catholic, but the northern part of Ireland, which is still part of the United Kingdom, is still part of the United Kingdom. They are what they call unionists or loyalists, meaning loyal to the crown, union standing for the United Kingdom. And you can get a bit of a window on the life that Patrick lived and the impact he had when you go to his places. And for example, when I went there with Nora, we were normally, she's the one kicking me under the table for making inappropriate comments and rude comments or being confrontational. And on this occasion, she made a statement that had me looking at her like, you've got to be kidding. This, our Irish host said, this is the Slemish Mountains, the tallest mountain in Northern Ireland. And Lenora, who's brought up in the Alps of Austria, said, but it's just a hill. And the only time I ever heard my wife making a comment that would have got me a kick under the table. But it is probably just a hill, but shame that these people are not brought up in the Alps. It's the best they've got, and this is an island called a mountain. And that's where Patrick began his work there. And of course, the harp is very much associated with the people of Ireland, and they say it's because descendants of King David moved to Ireland. And in fact, you get in the book of Jeremiah that at the end of Jeremiah's life and book, two of the daughters, two of the princesses of the last king of Judah came to Egypt, and they were then sent on, and they arrived in Ireland. And it is, in fact, in the 19th century, Queen Victoria ordered her lineage to be traced back. And these are published in, for example, a big, massive, thick, secular coffee table book on coronation, all the history of the coronations of England. And they've got the whole timeline of the descendants of, or I should say the ancestors of Queen Victoria, going all the way back to King David, traced through these princesses of the last king of Judah who had sought refuge in Ireland after the fall of Jerusalem, who Jeremiah had brought out of Israel. Very interesting, and it's believed that this is why the harp of David is part of the royal crest, and it's always part of Ireland, and it's part, and one of them, one of those princesses later married a Pict king who ended up in Scotland, and these ended up part of the British royal family. So that King Alfred the Great also believed he was descended from King Alfred, and this is why you've got the harp in many of the British royal crests. Interesting part of traditions. Now, to understand the Union Jack, the original flag of England is the St. George's Cross, which was also the Crusader flag of Richard the Lionheart. That's the St. George's Cross, red on white. The St. Andrew's Cross is the flag of Scotland, easily identifiable. So when England and Scotland united in the Grand Union flag of 1606 to 1801, they had this flag, the Union Jack. Later, when they added St. Patrick's Cross, which is the red on white, X, that formed the Union Jack, or Union flag, from 1801. Now, if you're seeing, for example, as I've seen some films that will depict this flag that only dates from 1801 in the American War of Independence, that's very anachronistic. They didn't have that flag. It's like people in the Second World War films having an American flag with all 50 stars in the flag. They didn't have 50 states then. They only had 48. They added Alaska and Hawaii only after the Second World War. So that would be anachronistic to have a 50-star flag. And similarly, you'll often see in movies they will depict the full Union Jack, which only came into existence in 1801, when Ireland was formally made part of the Union of the United Kingdom. But that's just to unravel the Union Jack to understand the history of that flag, which has got three crosses in one flag, which is quite impressive. And one of those flags, remember, is St. Patrick's Cross. Now, there's a lot of people who recognize St. Andrew's Cross, but how many recognize St. Patrick's Cross?
Wales?
Wales was a problem because their flag's the dragon. Very hard to fit a dragon in here. So basically, sorry Wales, they missed out because this just fit the unique flag structure. You can see the easily identifiable St. George's Cross, St. Andrew's Cross, St. Patrick's Cross. The dragon, Wales has got an interesting flag, but they missed out, sadly. So you've got four countries in the United Kingdom and three crosses. Another thing the people in Ireland are very proud of is that they built the Titanic. I'm surprised they're proud about that, but when you get to Belfast, they've got big billboards, you know, Titanic was made in Belfast. I wouldn't shout that from the rooftops of I was them, but still, it was a great ship, I suppose. And there's a memorial to the men who sacrificed their lives that the woman could live. Do you know, for every woman who drowned in the Titanic, 16 men drowned. And generally, despite the class warfare and other nonsense in the Titanic film, the men, including the richest men in the world, stood back and let working class women take their place in the lifeboat and went down with the ship because of this idea of women and children first. And so this is in memory of Belfast men who helped build the ship and who laid down their lives also that others could live when the ship went down. And then also in Belfast, interesting memorial outside the local library. What could this be to? Any guesses? C.S. Lewis. Do you know C.S. Lewis comes from Belfast? In fact, this is the wardrobe. Remember? The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. And so this is a memorial at the Belfast Library of C.S. Lewis. And it's born 1898, reborn 1931. C.S. Lewis, author of the Narnia series. And, well, yes, we also went to the place in Oxford where he would sit. He sat at this very place with J.R.R. Tolkien and discussed the books that they were going to write, and they were going through The Lord of the Rings and The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe at this particular place, this pub in Oxford, in England. But I've just jumped off there. Well, Ireland has been a place of troubles since the 1960s. And it went from being a police action to being a war action. And you can always tell when you're in the Catholic areas, very obviously in the Catholic areas, they have Irish flags. And by the way, the Irish flag's meant to be green for Catholic, orange for Protestants, and white for peace between them. That's the theory. Not that there's much peace between them most of the time, but still. As you can see, the Red Devil Bar, I think that's very appropriate. There's a famous bar for the IRA, and I think they knew who they were serving if they called it the Red Devil Bar. And you get all kinds of Fidel Castro, Che Guevara garbage on the walls. They said Belfast's the largest outdoor art museum in the world. And you literally get warning signs in traffic of beware of snipers. That's an official sign that you get in Northern Ireland. You can tell when you're entering Loyalist areas because they announce it, you know. You're now entering Loyalist Sandy Row, heartland of South Belfast, Ulster Freedom Fighters. And they will put up the flags, and you can see the Union Jack and the Irish Unionist flag and Her Sovereign Majesty Queen Elizabeth. And you could tell they're Protestant. There's no question. They're telling you the history of Ireland. They're telling you the history of the Catholic Church's atrocities and all the rest of it. And of course, Oliver Cromwell is almost like a patron saint, if you can say such a thing, of the Protestants in Northern Ireland, because he gave the Catholics their own medicine, and many of them look back to him as the best ruler they ever had. Ulster will always remain British, no surrender, the Red Hand. Now, you may wonder where the Red Hand comes from. Does anyone know the story of the Red Hand? The Red Hand is, as the Vikings were heading to Ireland. Now, remember, Dublin, for example, was founded by Vikings. And they say all the red hair in Ireland comes from the Vikings. At any rate, as they're coming along, two brothers are racing in rival boats, and the first one to lay his hand on the shore will possess this island. And they're rowing and rowing, and the one brother saw that his brother was going to get there before him. He chopped off his one hand and threw his hand, so his hand landed on the rocks before his brother could get there. How's that for being extreme in competition? And so the red hand symbolizes the name of this Viking who claimed Ireland for himself. Stormont is the Parliament of Northern Ireland, and it's synonymous with a Protestant parliament. The English wanted to betray the whole of Northern Ireland to the Irish Catholics after the Civil War that broke out from 1916 on and so on. The British government basically made a deal with the Irish: look, just hold your horses till the end of the war, help us win the war, and then we'll give you the whole of Ireland. And at the end of it, they were ready to, and Northern Ireland said, under no circumstance, we want to be loyalist, unionist, we want to be part of the United Kingdom, Protestant people. We cannot allow ourselves to become a Protestant minority persecuted by the Catholics. We know what that was like 400 years ago, not again. And so they actually fought the British government to be allowed to stay within Britain. And so after that, they built Stormont, which is one of the most magnificent parliaments anywhere in the world. It's so well built, and it's got so much space around it and beautiful forest. And when I went there as a guest of the First Minister, Ian Paisley was then First Minister of Northern Ireland. But the Irish Catholics did the kind of thing that, you know, people in South Africa did to our Parliament on the 2nd of January this year. They burned out the House of Parliament at one point, an IRA bomb, petrol bomb, whatever it was. Now, in the parliamentary rotunda. They've got in memory of one of their members of parliament who was murdered along with his son by IRA terrorists, 21st January 1981. And the IRA have been trying to get this out of it, but they put it in marble in the wall. It's very hard to get rid of this. Ian Paisley, for over 50 years, dominated the politics of Ireland. He's a strong Protestant pastor, evangelist, and he rallied the people of Ireland against the British government's attempts to betray them again and again. And he was not subtle, as he has here. If you can read this, it says, smash Sinn Féin. Sinn Féin is the IRA's political wing. Well, I heard Ian Paisley first preach at a minister's conference at Quasimunta Mission. I remember being shocked when I saw Ian Paisley stand up. I thought, how could Uncle Erlo allow this? I mean, I'd only heard terrible things about Ian Paisley. I mean, Ian Paisley was one of the worst, most evil, bloodthirsty, savage people on the planet, according to everything I'd heard. But as he stood up to speak, all my qualms disappeared. This, he preached from Psalm 2, and this is a man who loves God, this is a man who fears God, this is a man who preached the gospel. And thereafter, whenever I heard people speaking against Ian Paisley, which was frequently, I'd say, have you ever heard him preach? And I'd say, no. And I said, best gospel preacher I've ever heard. And I've heard a lot of good gospel preachers. And I had people staggered because they even say, surely you're joking. But no, Ian Paisley really was slandered. Well, we hit it off well at Quasimunta Mission, and he invited me back to Ireland to preach. And he said in the pulpit that Peter Hammond knows what the British government does because he was brought up in Rhodesia. What the British Foreign Office did to Rhodesia is what the British Home Office is trying to do to us in Ireland. And you can see where we're going. Now, Ian Paisley is famous for many things, but one of his greatest moments came in 1981 when Pope John Paul II came to speak at the European Parliament. And Ian Paisley happened to be a member of Parliament of the EU. In fact, he's 25 years representing Northern Ireland there, and he had the highest percentage, such a high percentage that even the Catholics in Northern Ireland must have been voting for him because he represented the interests so well. He didn't just have the support of all the Protestants, he had the support of some Catholics too. Well, anyway, Ian Paisley gave notice he was going to protest having the Pope speak to the European Parliament. They went ahead. So and you can actually Google and watch this, and as John Paul stands up to begin his speaking from the podium, Ian Paisley stands at the back and shouts out, John Paul, Antichrist, I defy you with all your false doctrines. And he put up the sign, Pope John Paul II, Antichrist. He's in fact quoting from Archbishop Thomas Cranmer, first Protestant Archbishop of England, who was, of course, burned at the stake by Bloody Mary. And so some people came up and ripped it out of his hands. He pulled another one out. And he carried on, John Paul, Antichrist, I defy you with all your false doctrines. And poor John Paul's trying to speak, but nobody can hear him over. Ian Paisley did not need a PA system. And every time they ripped the piece of paper out of his hand, he pulled out another one. And he had apparently 27 copies in his pocket. He kept pulling out another one. And in the end, they really injured his arm, so he's in a sling for a while. And they couldn't move him out because he is a member of the European Parliament. At the end, the newspaper said, nobody can remember what Pope John Paul said, but everyone can remember what Ian Paisley said. And here's, I saw this picture in his office, and it's got European Parliament, home of the Antichrist, and it's useless, Your Holiness, his voice keeps blowing out the flames. And they're trying to burn him at the stake. It's got heretic written on it. Well, that's the kind of opposition he got. Well, Ian Paisley is an outdoor street preacher. He would tackle issues, and he is in the Guinness Book of Records, having turned the greatest majority over in any one election. He went from being the smallest party in Parliament to being the dominant party in Parliament because he mobilized the people against the British government's plans to betray Northern Ireland. He was the longest serving member of Parliament in the House of Westminster in England. And in fact, he was, I think, 40 years or was 42 years member of Parliament in Westminster while running a church and a denomination and a Bible college and a political party, and also being a member of European Parliament. So he was one of those sort of people. The biggest meeting ever held in Belfast, this is the Queen Victoria monument in the front of Belfast City Hall. 250,000 people gathered for an Ian Paisley rally. That's more than the entire population of Belfast. So people must have come in from the surrounding areas too. And you can see the main message on this banner. No. The British government was trying to betray, this was Tony Blair was trying to betray, I think it was in 2005, trying to betray Northern Ireland in the hands of Irish Republic again under Catholics. And Ian Paisley rallied the people for a firm, resounding no or niet. On the Kenom Standard is here Mal Baslisny, and that was so effective. He won the next election, swept the opposition into history, and the DUP became the kingmakers thereafter. He was someone who was forthright, he would preach against sin, and he established a free church, the Free Presbyterian Churches in Northern Ireland, which by the end of his ministry on earth had 100 congregations already, and something like 50,000 members, very effective, very powerful, conservative, hymn singing, psalm singing, and King James Version only type of people, very serious ministry. And so he's the only person I know of who's been able to have a political career and a church career and do a good job of both, which is absolutely extraordinary. Here's a massive prayer rally on the grounds of Stormont. I mean, when I went to Northern Ireland, I had no idea there were still dedicated Christians like this in Europe. Northern Ireland is the brightest spot spiritually in the whole of Western Europe. And every Friday, midday, Ian Paisley would preach in front of the Queen Victoria Monument, in front of the downtown City Hall in Belfast, and he invited me to preach there on one Friday lunchtime. In fact, it was Good Friday, interestingly enough, and it was an Easter convention, and he said, you know, give the gospel hot and heavy for these papers. He's got PA system. He said people can hear us for a quarter of a mile away, even locked in their offices. And so, interestingly enough, I don't know if you can spot, there's the odd special branch policeman around. Ian Paisley was actually arrested and imprisoned several times over for outdoor preaching, because the British installed nobody's allowed to have public meetings during the Troubles. And Ian Paisley continued to preach, and they said, well, we can give you an exception. He says, I will not seek an exception for preaching the gospel. This is Ireland. It's my birthright. It's a gospel privilege. It's our responsibility. I will preach in the open air, and I don't need to ask anyone's permission to do it. So in the end, the British had to change the law just for him, and then they had to provide him bodyguards. And this is a police armored car, by the way, parked in front of us, and they had them around because they're afraid of someone driving in German with a car bomb, and they had snipers on the rooftops. They had to provide security for him because he had the same level of security as the Queen of England, higher than that of the British Prime Minister. In fact, he said he hasn't had to buy a car, pay for petrol or service for a vehicle for the last 20-something years, because he's got so many death threats. He's at the top of the list of the IRA, that the British police provide him with drivers, cars. He had driven armored cars, just feeling the doors. I mean, so heavy. I mean, all his windows in his home, his offices, even church office, changed by the police. They came and put thick armor-plated windows in, and they drive him everywhere. Wherever we were going, we had special branch driving us around, because Ian Paisley was at the top of the IRA hit list. And he had me preach the gospel, as he said, hot and heavy, so the papists can hear it. I think you can see some of these security folks in the background. They always kind of stand out, don't they? They can't exactly merge with the paintwork that well. Ian Paisley's church was Martyrs Memorial Free Presbyterian Church, and 95 theses in the door. The British flag and the Irish flag up front, we preach Christ crucified. You didn't need to be guessing as to where he stood. And this is a Wednesday night meeting, by the way. Wednesday night meeting. And I wasn't there for a Sunday service because they had me preaching in four different churches on Sunday. But this is the kind of midweek services, and the fervor, the enthusiasm, the prayer meetings, the zeal. Ian Paisley would say, I want men to stay behind and pray, and we'd pray till early hours of the morning. And then we'd still be out there doing outreaches. I asked him, are you evangelizing amongst the Catholics? He said, we are putting a Gospel of John in every Catholic home, not only in Northern Ireland, but in Southern Ireland as well. And when I inquired a bit more, he said, oh, would you like to join my man? So he had me picked up the next day by one of his evangelists. By the way, you see the red hand the six-pointed star because six provinces, the crown, of course, because they're royalist, and United Kingdom flag because they're unionist. So that's the Northern Irish flag. This, by the way, is a youth rally. I had four church services in the one Sunday, and my last one started at 9, went past midnight at this youth rally that had already been going for a while when I got there. And you look at this, you might think this picture was taken centuries ago, but these are young people in 2005. And every woman wearing hats, every man ties and jackets. There's just one backslider here, and he's a South African. This chap here, he's not wearing a tie or a jacket. Shame on him. But anyway, all the others are. And but aside from that, you can see the kind of clothing standards that they had in Northern Ireland. Now, this youth rally, there was no gimmicks, there's no bands, there was no plays. It was testimonies, prayer, preaching, and with me answering questions. For over an hour, I answered questions. Very enthusiastic key people, tremendous ministry, and a patriot who loves the Lord and who's enthusiastic. This is one of our, notice I'm called a fundamentalist. Over there, fundamentalist is a good word. Means you hold to the fundamentals of the faith. I think in America, fundamentalist would often be a negative connotation. So these are just some of the services they organized back when Lenore and I were traveling there in 2009. 150th anniversary of the revival. 1859, there was a phenomenal revival in Ireland. And by the way, Ian Paisley's wife was later made a baroness, and he was made a lord in the House of Lords, and his son entered politics as a member of parliament, his other son a minister. So they ended up with three Paisleys in the British Parliament, two in the House of Lords and one in the House of Commons. So things really got out of hand there. And so Ian Paisley personally took Lenore and I around Ireland to see the different sites of the revival of 1859. And it was in this schoolhouse that one of the most amazing revivals began. One of these young boys was challenged by a school teacher, could you not do something more for God? Could you not gather some of your careless friends for a Bible study, a prayer meeting each week? And so every Friday night they would carry coals in their arms to the schoolhouse and heat up the fireplace, warm up the room, and then they, through prayer, warmed up their hearts. And these four, later five, later six, nine, 12, grew to 54, meeting every Friday night for prayer. And revival started to break out in the schools. The school teacher saw one of the youngsters was obviously in a state of conviction, and he asked this young boy, could he not take him and counsel him? So he took him to counsel him, and after a while he came back. And this youngster walked into the classroom and he shouted to the teacher, oh, sir, I have Jesus in my heart. And as he said that, people in the class began to break down and weep. And people got on their knees and people started to pray. And the teacher asked those who knew the Lord to counsel their fellows who did not know the Lord. And they spread out and somewhere outside in the playground. And as they started to counsel, some of them start to cry aloud, and the girls who are in the upper section of the school looked out the windows, and conviction came upon them, and without anyone saying a word, the girls fell on their knees and started to weep and to cry and to confess their sins. Adults were coming past, and they heard these cries and shrieks from the school and just sounds of commotion, and the parents were arrested, but conviction of sin came upon them, and they fell on their knees on the cobblestones and in the mud and in the sand. They knelt down in the streets and prayed. And it was 11 o'clock at night before the school was able to be cleared and they could shut and lock the doors. Extraordinary prayer meetings were organized. The next day, people came into the center of the town to seek. We've got the whole story and several books on this on the 1859 revival down in the library, and started to seek for counsel, and the pastors had so many people gathered in the town square they couldn't reach them all. They didn't have a PA system. They divided them up. I think there were four pastors divided into four different groups, and the people soon were on their knees in the streets in the town square praying, seeking God. This church had a meeting where the people gathered for revival to such an extent. Business places had regular prayer meetings. This spread from one place to the other. Prayer meetings from 12 o'clock to 1 o'clock. Prayer is the Christian's native breath, the Christian's native air. His watchword at the gates of death, he enters heaven with prayer. Him that comes to me, I will nowise cast out. Prayers and exhortations not to exceed 5 minutes, nor to give all an opportunity. No more than 2 consecutive prayers or exhortations, no controverted points discussed. How many prayer meetings need to have signs out like that these days? And this attracted people from around the world. Even Charles Spurgeon came to preach in Ireland to accommodate the amount of hunger and thirst for revival. This is the 1859 revival. I've been to all these places with Ian Paisley, Ballymena, Coleraine, Agog Hill, Kilchney, New Tandards. Amazing, extraordinary, and there were many centenary celebrations. Many churches were celebrating, and you had displays like these set up, remembering the revival on the Emerald Isle back in 1859. And this will remind you, we in South Africa had our revival in 1860. It spread over here by the next year, and Andrew Murray was most associated with that one, started in Worcester. But you can see some of these churches where the revival prayer meetings took place, and you can see from the stained glass windows, the doctrines of grace. Many of these were put up after that time. The strong Reformation doctrines and the principles of the Reformation of 5 solas. And you can see many of the great names of the faith recognized. In this particular church, they had an upper gallery and lower area. And so many people in that they feared the upper gallery would break and give way. So they plead for the people to go outside. And although there was a light drizzle, the people gathered outside, knelt on the cobblestones and in the mud and the dirt outside, getting wet in the rain, praying on their knees for a long time. And these are just some of the places where you see what the symbol is of the Presbyterian Church in Ireland, the burning bush, the presence of God. Well, these days we more often call Presbyterian churches the chosen frozen rather than people on fire. But what was John Calvin's motto? A heart aflame in the hand of God. The prayer that was used in the 1859 revival was reprinted for this occasion by Ian Paisley, distributed, and this is the prayer. I take God the Father to be my God. I take God the Son to be my Savior. I take God the Holy Spirit to be my sanctifier. I take the Word of God to be my rule. I take the people of God to be my people. I likewise dedicate myself wholly to the Lord. And I do this prayerfully, deliberately, sincerely, freely, and forever. What a great prayer. When I think of Patrick, I can only think of a person who had, he had privilege, but then he lost it all. And you know, he could have chosen to be a victim of his circumstances. What can I do? It's not my fault. I'm a victim of circumstance. But no, he took it to be his fault. He had neglected the Lord. He had neglected the means of grace. He had not applied the faith of his parents to his life. He was living effectively without the Lord. Now this is God's judgment. And then he didn't just say, well, now I'm doomed to be a slave the rest of my life. He took choices. He took ownership. He could have had, Patrick could have had an excuse why his life would amount to nothing. But Patrick decided to follow God, to trust God. And he's an example of when you don't have much on your side, how you can still turn it all around. And again, you could say, what difference can I make? What difference could some slave whose only experience in life is being a sheep and pig shepherd? I mean, really? And yet, it wasn't him, it was the gospel. Patrick didn't change Ireland. The gospel of Christ changed Ireland. To such an extent, it's still having its ripple effects there. There are missionaries all over the world from the work of what God did in Ireland. I've bumped into Irish missionaries all over the place. I must say quite a few of them are Roman Catholic. But you can still see the impact. There's many Protestant Irish missionaries too. By the way, I was up in Nuba Mountains some years ago, and there was a Catholic Jesuit missionary from Ireland up there. And I knew the Catholics also had a mission station up in Nuba Mountains. And so one day this man came, you know, with his long flowing gowns, and he came to meet me. I felt sorry for him. He's got to walk around in the Nuba Mountains heat like that, 45, 48 degrees Celsius. And he said, I hear that you've got a flight coming in next week. And I said, yes, I do. He said, would you have place for on it for me to fly? I said, place on one of my planes to fly a Catholic missionary out of the mission field? Of course, there's always a space to fly Catholic missionaries out of the field. I could make it one of my key result areas. So, you know, he laughed and said, I'd never have space to bring you in, but I've always got space to take you out. And, you know, he's glad. And, you know, we knew where we were coming from and we had some good fellowship. There are times that I've been in Catholic churches in Nuba Mountains and Mozambique and so on. They said, why are you bringing us Bibles and visiting us? And I said, well, if I can give Bibles to Catholics without being burned at the stake, I count myself blessed. And, you know, it's an interesting thing. Catholics have gone from being our enemies to being our sort of brothers-in-law. They have the same enemy. They've been persecuted by the same Muslims and communists and secular humanists. And so we can find often some common ground talking to them because they are pro-life, generally, and they are obviously, if they're being bombed by jihadists, they're against Islam and Marxism and so on. So we can find some common ground with Roman Catholics and use that as a basis for developing a relationship. But also, what's so important is when they start seeing, you also recognize and respect Patrick. Oh, you also like Francis of Assisi. And they're astounded. What? You actually study St. Augustine as well? And they're amazed. Tertullian, Origen, yeah. Well, these are our church fathers too. I said, you know, Roman Catholics don't own the church fathers. They belong to all believers. And there's a tremendous opening that comes with Catholics when they realize you don't reject all of our heritage. Now, we thought you Protestants only started in 1517. No. We look all the way back to the Acts of the Apostles and the Gospels, back to Christ. And we are trying to get back to the Bible, back to the New Testament. We're not trying to start a new religion. And for many Catholics, this is a surprise. So I think Patrick is a key that can help you to reach out to Catholics, and especially Irish Catholics, that when they realize we've actually got a few more things in common, they might be more open to hearing the gospel from you when they realize you don't reject everything that they have taken as precious in their life. So any questions, any comments on Patrick of Ireland?
In most of the depictions of Patrick, we see he had a staff and a clover leaf in the one hand. Obviously, the staff had a practical purpose, but what was the symbolic meaning of the leaf?
Yes. He found the people in Ireland would not understand the concept of a Trinity, and he's a very Trinitarian evangelist. And he used the clover leaf, which in Ireland is always three sides, and to depict God the Father, God the Son, God the Holy Spirit. And so depicting with a clover leaf does seem to be very much part of the story of Patrick. It just emphasizes Trinitarianism. But while he would have had a staff, it's unlikely there would have been an ornate shepherd staff, which is more traditional ritual for the Catholic Church. It's more like a badge of rank these days, like a marshal's baton in a sense. So highly unlikely he ever was dressed in that kind of garb, which is ceremonial, not very practical to have worn hiking through the heather on the moors of Ireland. Other comments, questions? Daniel.
Dr. Peter, you said that the people in Ireland, they were quite savage, vicious, and the Druids and so on. So, I mean, when he preached to those kings, was that what their tribes were like?
And generally, yes.
And so yes. When they got converted, did that all like start changing them?
It did change. In fact, this is something that makes one question what's wrong with the gospel being preached today. Because you take people like Boniface, who went to the Saxons in Germany, and Ulfilas, who went to the Goths, and you look at Patrick, who went to Irish. Things changed. The whole culture changed. The people changed. They were transformed. So what's wrong with our gospel today that we can go and preach the gospel to people and it continue to be drunkards and body piercing and having abortions and getting involved in LGBTQ perversion? And what kind of gospel is that? And If the gospel we preach doesn't change people's lives, it's not the gospel. Because the gospel requires change. The heart of the gospel is change. And so, the moment a person gets the gospel is, no, it may not be immediate everything, but there's going to be change. Thieves will stop stealing and they'll do restitution, and drunkards will stop getting drunk and they will start to put their money into caring for their family, and gamblers will no longer gamble their family's money away. They'll actually start putting the money to the family. There should be change. And so it's very strange how modern gospel doesn't change people. I think it's been critiqued well that the old gospel was the rough cross. Take up your cross, follow me, die to yourself, die to the world, be born again. The modern smooth cross is more like an ornament. It's not an instrument of death at all. And what you've got today is accept Jesus. Jesus came to make your life better without any inconveniences. And it's all become a health and wealth and prosperity. What can I get out of it? Ask not what God wants you to do. Ask what God can do for you kind of mentality. Where it's all about me. And as the American gospel form depicted, where the modern gospel is more about where I am the star and God is a supporting actor in a story that's all about me. Whereas in the Bible, the gospel is all about God. It's the gospel of the kingdom, the king and his. And the gospel of salvation is part of the gospel of the kingdom, but it's a small part. The biggest part is God, his kingdom, and his plans for the world. Of course, the gospel of salvation is an important element, but it's a very subordinate part. The main emphasis is the King of Kings and his great commission and his kingdom. Seek first the kingdom of God and his righteousness. So we've got a man-centered, superficial, shallow, materialistic gospel today that's not changing people's lives. And so I think that's why Look at Patrick is just so inspiring, because here's someone who went and he changed a country and he launched a missionary movement. And it's a phenomenal achievement. And it lives on, especially in Northern Ireland at least. Yes, Luke.
When the Roman Empire went into Britain, did that, because the Britons went, did they go back to where they were before the Roman Empire, or did the Roman Empire not affect their culture that much?
No, there's no doubt the Roman Empire dramatically changed the behavior of the Britons in the areas they controlled, which would be south of Hadrian's Wall. They didn't obviously ever try to get into Pict land or Scotland. They didn't even think about Ireland. I think the Irish were considered too savage for them to control. And, well, the Picts were as well. I mean, the Scots were so bad, that's why they built Hadrian's Wall, the biggest fortification structure in the world at that time. But the Britons in Roman-controlled England, like Patrick's family, became awfully civilized, used to a high level of culture and hygiene and everything else. And they had these aqueducts and heated baths and what have you. And so you can imagine that they got quite soft, whereas the previous Britons had also been quite savage. And you look at what Boadicea did with the Romans and so on, it was pretty brutal too. So it's the natural state of people before the gospel comes is to be quite savage and brutal. It's only the gospel that civilizes and saves and changes people anyway. I think it's good to remind all people that before the gospel came, you were savage. And when you abandon the gospel, it won't be long and you'll be savage again. And you can see it in our societies. When people abandon the gospel, it doesn't take millenniums and centuries. It takes one generation. You can have a person who's the son of an engineer, and he can be some drug addict burgie on the street. So it just takes one generation. You can go right back to the Stone Age if you want to. And unfortunately, drugs helps people do that too. Hollywood's really helping. I think the death metal music takes people even further down it.
Another
yes.
Question is, when did Pict land become Scotland?
Well, there are people who distinguish between the Picts and the Scots, because the Picts was a specific tribe in Scotland. As you can see, there are several tribes in Ireland now, what coalesce in Ireland. Just like what we call England today, it includes the Jutes and the Angles and the Saxons, and of course the Normans later. So there's some distinct groups. And yet they merged into a national identity, but within, just like somebody would say, you're a South African, you could say, well, but I'm a Kopenaar, or I'm a Free State, or I'm a Transvaaler, and you're distinguishing tribal groupings within that national identity. So the Picts were always a tribe of Scotland. But at some point, the Scots were considered to be the predominant, and Pictland just got merged into Scotland. Yeah. But today, I know some Scottish friends who still have a sign on their car or above their door, Pict. And obviously, harking back to a more primitive, savage form of Scot, probably meaning, don't mess with me, I'm ready to fight, I guess. You know, it's like if I'm to try and reassert the Viking ancestry of the Hammonds, that, you know, there was a time when we used to drink blood out of skulls and split people's heads with Dane axes. But we got converted somewhere along the line and we've got more civilized since. But why would you emphasize that side? It's just because you're trying to emphasize we're capable of being brutal, savage warriors if we push too far, which is what I think. When you put Picts up there, you think this person is a lot more serious than a Scot. They're a more, you know, it's like the difference between a person who would say, I'm not an Afrikaner, I'm a Boer. I mean, that suggests, you know, the average Afrikaner is a bit weak. The Boers, we fighters, we, you know. So it's a tougher part. Like if a person calls me English and I say, I'm Rhodesian. Rhodesian suggests a more serious type of English speaker. And so on. So I think that's what depicts me. Other comments, observations?
I remember being in Scotland and during the day there was, outside some pubs, there was policemen and there was busy a game that was going on, like a
football?
Football game. And the police were out there because there's such rivalry between the Protestants and the Catholics. Depending on who won, they might start fighting. So,
oh, yeah.
So there was policemen outside.
It wouldn't necessarily even be Protestant Catholic. It could just be rival teams. Just the rival team.
Yeah,
Britain,
Irish
it's.
And the Scottish.
Oh, well, I mean, whoever won, there'd be a fight afterwards. Yes. I mean, that's part of it. The people are not just spectators, they're serious participants in those football matches. It goes deep and far. I mean, even take my own father. He had expressed several times he can't believe that Britain wasted time fighting for the French twice. He said, you know, our real enemy is the French. He should have been fighting the French. You know, he's talking about First and Second World War. So that's a typical English mentality that, you know, the French are real enemies. Why are we fighting with them on their side? And then you get these people who, you know, I'm a Manchester supporter and, you know, when Manchester's playing football against, what would the competition be?
Liverpool.
Yes, well, I mean, Liverpool, Manchester, that's serious rivalry. You know, from our distance, we say, I can't tell the difference, but to them, it's a very serious, and the antagonism and the rivalry goes deep. Just take in rowing in England, Cambridge and Oxford, the rowing teams, it is furious competition. And the Cambridge and Oxford rowing teams take it super, super seriously. I mean, this is like the whole year is dedicated to beating the competition in that rowing. And in some ways, sports is a peaceful alternative to war. If you can channel people's aggression and rivalry in sport, it's a far better way than having warfare, which is why I don't believe in sports boycotts ever. I don't believe in sanctions either. I don't think it ever helps in case of war. By the way, sanctions was meant to crush Rhodesia and South Africa. It didn't. I don't think sanctions will do anything for Russia that the West wants. The thing that sanctions do is they bring the people of that targeted nation more together. And so all that sanctions did in Rhodesia was it made Rhodesians more united, more innovators, and what we couldn't import, we made ourselves, and there was a greater sense of us versus them. And I think to isolate sportsmen just because they're Russian right now, that's wrong. If you want to punish the politicians, fine. But don't punish the average person. And the sportsmen, how much better than to have the sportsmen of different opposing nations to actually be interacting with one another, even competitively, at a time of war? That's a perfect channel for people to deal with it in a way that people don't get killed. And I think all sports boycotts should be opposed on principle. Yeah. So, any other comments, observations? Toby.
I don't know much about the origins of the IRA, but considering the damage that they've done, Would they be considered more a political organization or a terrorist organization?
The IRA are a terrorist organization, but Sinn Féin is the political arm. And so in South Africa, for example, you had Umkhonto weSizwe is the terrorist arm, or the armed wing, as they're called, of the ANC. The ANC is a political party, whereas Umkhonto weSizwe was the terrorist arm. So without a question, Umkhonto weSizwe was listed as a terrorist organization. They would call them a revolutionary armed struggle movement. That's their terminology. But that's the difference. So in Ireland, the Sinn Féin is a political party, registered, and they've got people in parliament, and IRA were the people wearing a ski mask who are throwing the petrol bomb, the grenades, kneecapping people, shooting people from behind and so on. So Sinn Féin was the respectable face of the IRA terrorists. The IRA is meant to be suspending operations at the moment. That would be nice. They've got a ceasefire in place in Ireland, which we're grateful for.